We'll be taking phone calls a little bit later. I do want to say that, by the way, that's the Beatles side two of Abbey Road. You Never Give Me Your Money. We'll be following the money in this hour. It's I don't know if it's a coincidence or not, but it certainly is intriguing that some people had the foresight to buy airline stocks, to essentially bet against the airline stocks to make a whole bunch of money in a very short time by assuming that something really bad was going to happen to airline stocks. And then, of course, a lot of people followed the money that was spent, the trillions of dollars spent on armaments, on war, on the security apparatus, that all the cameras that we see around us now, almost unlimited sums. A lot of people made money on that. Could that have been a factor in setting up 9/11, setting this whole sequence of events into motion? We're going to get into that. Take some of your phone calls in just a little bit here on Coast to Coast AM. Joseph Farrell, let's talk about money, the profiteering involved in this. It may be a side benefit, but if somebody was going to pull off an operation of this size and magnitude and complexity, I guess they'd figure, well, why not make a little dough on the side while we're at it? You mentioned in the book about the folks, unknown folks, who had amazing foresight in shorting airline stocks. And then, of course, you know, if you want to look at a bigger picture, I guess a lot of people made money on the trillions of dollars spent on armaments, the war machine, the security apparatus, all that. Is that central to this, or is it a side benefit?
I think it is. You know, when you look at the stock purchases, not even just with the airlines, but with the insurance, AIG was shorted. There were defense industries, on the other hand, that were bought, and so on. But when you look at the airline shorts themselves, they are in wildly, statistically erratic patterns prior to 9/11 for about a week, and concentrating specifically on American and United Airlines, which of course were the principal airlines involved in on 9/11. And it's very interesting, when you look at those shorts, one of the key players that was shorting those two airlines was Lufthansa, you know, the German national airline. And I always thought that was a bit peculiar, particularly given some of the other patterns that we've seen. But let's look at that pattern another way. Let's go back to the JFK assassination for a moment. And I do not mention this in the book, but I think it is crucial to looking at these deeper patterns that the deep state evidences when events like this are being planned. If you go back to the JFK assassination, there was a number of shorts that were placed on the U.S. stock market for the day of his assassination. And one of the companies heavily involved in that activity was a company by the name of Bunge and Born, B-U-N-G-E and Born, based in Argentina, but it was actually a German company that was shorting a particular American vegetable oil company to the tunes of tens of millions of dollars on that particular day. And they made a lot of money, and there has always been speculation that there was some sort of inside knowledge there. But with 9/11, the pattern is very, very clear. It's across the board. It's in insurance. It's in the defense contracting field. It's in the airlines themselves. Some of the people placing these shorts, as I mentioned, are private individuals. There were Lufthansa, and the most interesting buyer of securities, of U.S. government securities, in the week prior to 9/11 was the U.S. government itself. So, you know, there are all sorts of indicators that the deep state is involved in these things.
You mentioned Warrenitis, the term that, I don't know if you coined it, but sort of the comparison to the Warren Commission, the 9/11 Commission looking into this. Among the things they looked at is who had the foresight, the amazing foresight, to buy United Airlines stock and short it, which, right, you know, it only pays off if something really bad goes wrong. Right. And of course they said, oh, there's nothing suspicious at all here.
There's nothing suspicious at all here, exactly. And, you know, that's the pattern that the 9/11 Truth Commission took, not only with regard to United Airlines, but American Airlines. But again, the amount of activity in the shorts for those two airlines in the week prior to 9/11, I think the figures are somewhere between 50% and 60% above the average shorts for those airlines in a given trading period. So that tells us right there that there was huge insider knowledge that this operation was definitely going to be cashed in on by somebody. Now, the other interesting thing about this is that some of these shorts were for very small amounts of money, and a lot of them were never claimed. So there's still money on the books waiting to be claimed. And the most interesting thing about that for me personally is that the 9/11 Commission, and for that matter the 9/11 Truth Movement, hasn't yet uncovered who some of these people are. So we don't know exactly where all of this is coming from. What we do know is that the United States government was purchasing massive amounts of U.S. Treasury bonds, which would, of course, after 9/11 go up in terms of their value on the market, on the bond markets. And then, of course, we had that Lufthansa activity with United and American Airlines that is rather suspicious, given all the other weird connections that we've been talking about.
So let's talk about level three, who these people are. You think they're Nazis or remnants of Nazis or the descendants of Nazis, something not so much like Odessa, but more like Spectre from James
right,
Bond.
Exactly. I talk a lot about the Nazi International. I talk a lot about fascist mafias and so on. I think what you are looking at with this global network that Tony Blair and Tatiana Koryagina talked about, I think what you're looking at, George, in all honesty, is an alliance, basically, that was forged toward the end of World War II and then continued for some time after World War II. Between the American fascist crowd, you know, think of John Foster Dulles, Alan Dulles, John McCloy, and people like this, and that surviving group of Axis elite in Europe that became such a crucial component and member of the early Bilderberg meetings and so on. I'm thinking of people like Dr. Hermann Josef Ops of Deutsche Bank and so on and so forth. If you look at that alliance, what you really have is a mafia. You have people with their own factional interests that crawl into bed with each other for various purposes after World War II. And I think it's entirely possible that what you're looking at on 9/11 is the capos sitting around the table smoking their cigars and sipping their brandy and putting on their rings have started shooting at each other. I really do think some element of this is involved. And let me give you one other reason why I think that. I think if you look at the bailout hearings of 2008 within this wider context, it always struck me as very peculiar in those hearings that the Federal Reserve and the other bankers were insisting that this bailout money that they were asking Congress to fork over to them have absolutely no oversight. And that struck me at the time that was behavior akin to people with a gun to their head. It's akin to people that, you know, have been victims of a kidnapping and trying to raise ransom money, and the kidnappers are saying, well, you know, don't go to the police or the deal's off. So it's akin to something like that. That whole behavior and that whole episode, I think, is kind of itself deeply related in some way, that's my intuition, to 9/11.
You know, if you look for fascism in the world, whether you're looking for Nazis or sons of grandsons of Nazis, you don't have to look too far to see an interest in fascism or something close to it. The marriage of government and corporations, and
yes, exactly.
You know, in this country too.
In this country and all over the Western world. And this is why I find the presence of that Nazi banker so late in the game and so deeply in bed with the Saudis and every other kind of neo-fascist cause that I find so very suspicious. It was that, plus the Mohammed Atta connection to that, you know, to the IG Farben Society, for want of a better expression, in post-war Germany, that kind of, to me, indicates that there's a pattern here that needs much deeper scrutiny. And then, of course, as I mentioned earlier, you have Senator Graham's statement that foreign governments were involved, and that if the American people knew exactly what was contained in those classified 28 pages, it would be explosive. And everything, my gut tells me that you're going to find, you know, not just Saudi Arabia, which I think everybody kind of has suspected all along, given the fact that the Bush administration helped get a lot of Saudis out of the country secretly in the aftermath of 9/11, but that you're going to have other players that are going to pop up, that there will be threads connecting these other players to that deep layer.
You noted somewhere in the book, I'm trying to remember where, but I think it was Martin Bormann, 1944, mm-hmm. some kind of a meeting was held. The Nazis are still hanging on. They're in trouble, but they're not dead yet. Bormann has some kind of a meeting where he instructs people, basically, start stashing dough and setting yourself up in other parts of the world. We've all read about the Nazis going to Argentina and hiding in South America. And,
right.
you know, you think, you read the stories that most of them were caught or punished, or maybe a few of them got away, but the general idea that there's a substantial power that got away
right.
is not generally accepted. Do you think that that is the case, though?
Yes, I do. That meeting took place at the Hotel Maison Rouge in August of 1944, and basically what Bormann told the German industrialists to do was open up a bunch of front companies around the world, and we know of 750 American and British Treasury agents were successful in at least tracking down that number. The claim is out there that they were successful in recovering most of that Nazi loot, but there are researchers that dispute that, particularly some within the Treasury Department that have disputed that, that in fact a lot of that loot survived. I do think that it's the case that we are dealing with something like that, because I've tried, I spent a lot of time in one of my books, The Nazi International, talking about what they were up to in Argentina, and it goes far beyond hiding out in grass huts and wearing grass skirts in the Amazon basin. They were involved in some pretty sophisticated scientific research, which means that they had a huge bankroll. So my standing joke is, if you're making deals, you know, if you're Alan Dulles and so on, making deals with Martin Bormann at the end of the war, it's kind of like dealing with Dick Cheney without the warmth and charm, because at some point you're dealing really with a network that has its own intelligence, that has its own financing and so on. And sooner or later, that marker is going to come due. So again, we're back to the mafia model, basically.
You know, our friend Richard Dolan has written about breakaway civilizations, yes. and you touch on that a little bit.
Yes.
I don't know if that's that fits what you are describing here. It's more like not so much a breakaway civilization as an embedded organization. They're everywhere.
Yeah, I think it's a bit of both, quite honestly. I think he has a profound insight there, because one aspect of what he was talking about in those UFO National Security State books is that if over time you have created a mechanism to funnel vast amounts of money into covert research projects to invent exotic technologies. And this, of course, is a Nazi thing right off the bat. But if you're doing that, the possibility arises that this group of people will eventually pull so far away from the public civilization that they, in effect, become kind of a breakaway group. And I do believe very definitely that the post-war Nazi outfit was deeply, deeply embedded in that superstructure and very influential. And it may be that, again, that on 9/11, divorce papers of some sort were served. You have all of the appearances on 9/11 that the Bush administration and aspects of the American deep state are in some sort of panic mode. And you see that again with those bailout hearings. There's all the earmarks of carefully disguised panic taking place. And now we have this global war on terror, which might be a global war against something very, very different.
Well, it's a perpetual war, on one level at least. It's a war that can never end and never be won. And
right.
it'll go on forever, and we'll continue spending money and liberty slipping through our fingers year after year.
Yep, exactly. And that may have been a goal, you know, that may have been a goal of all of this, is to create that sort of climate. You know, the clues are there for anybody that's willing to look. And again, you know, it's not just me saying this. You've got people in Russia, very highly placed, that have talked about global networks. You've got Tony Blair and so on and so forth. So, yeah, I think it's there. And I think it's kind of a global fascist mafia with deep connections. And the other clue to this is, of course, the fact that you had so many countries all warning us that this was going to happen. And it's kind of a commonplace now that most of these national intelligence agencies have some sort of interface with the international mafia, the international drug running community, as a source of private funding for their covert projects, you know, that's totally off the books and not subject to their government scrutiny. So with that, again, that's another indicator you're really dealing with a global network.
Well, you know, we've all read the reports about warnings that were given. They all seem kind of amorphous in general, that were given to the White House in the months leading up to 9/11. Not very specific. It's an attack that's coming, but we're not quite sure when and where. But the warnings you're talking about in the book are pretty specific. Multiple.
They're tremendously specific. One of the most interesting warnings, George, I think personally, is the warnings that Russia gave us. The Russian warnings were very specific. They were talking in terms of 20 to 25 hijackers flying American civil airliners into various prominent American targets, you know, the Sears Tower, the World Trade Center, and so on and so forth. So it was very, very specific in nature. And if I recall correctly, President Putin, shortly after 9/11, gave an interview where he said and stated that he had attempted to warn the Bush administration in very, very specific terms, and kind of gave the indication that he had personally done this. And, you know, once you start talking in terms of that kind of specificity, and again, you know, I've mentioned the Taliban even gave some very specific warnings that airplanes would be used in terrorist attacks on the United States. So these warnings are coming all from all over, and in some cases they're very, very specific.
We've got a lot of people on the phones. I think I'm going to wait till after the break to go to them. You know, the idea of false flags, it seems like anything that happens anywhere in the world, people are so attuned to the idea of false flags, it doesn't take more than an hour before somebody on social media, whatever happens anywhere,
right,
it's a false flag. And I you know, it becomes counterproductive at some level, but after you read something like this book, you have to wonder.
Well, I think that's a very good point. I think this is part of the climate that 9/11 has created in and of itself. And in that respect, it's not a bad thing, because people are becoming very, very attuned to the playbook, so to speak, of false flag operations. You now have out there in some aspect of the public, in some sectors, the idea that any time the government is scheduling drills, this is when things start to happen. And of course, think of the London bombings in 2007. Those occurred during drills that were mirroring actual aspects of what actually took place. So I think the climate is there, and to a certain extent, 9/11 itself helped galvanize that. So in a certain sense, it's kind of like the JFK of our times. It's something that has made people sit up and question their governments, question the global elites behind them, question this whole notion of corporate control of everything. In that respect, I think it has done some good.
We've sort of been sort of like a skipping a rock over a lake because
right.
So many details about the topics we're touching on, we've just kind of barely touched on and didn't go into much depth. So I encourage people to check out the book. It's Hidden Finance, Rogue Networks, and Secret Sorcery, The Fascist International, 9/11, and the Penetrated Operations by Joseph P. Farrell. We've got links on our website if you want to check out the book, and I encourage you to do so. I'd also like to ask you, if we have time when we come back in the next segment, if there was a super weapon that was used against the Twin Towers to take them down, where it might be, because that, you know, if you have speculation on that, but the phone lines are pretty full, and we'll get to as many folks' calls as we can here in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. We'll be right back. Lowell George of Little Feet wrote that classic, a great cover by Linda Ronstadt. The song is called Willing, and I've driven those roads, Tehachapi to Tonopah, and a couple of other ones there. We're talking with Joseph Farrell about his excellent new book, Hidden Finance, Rogue Networks, and Secret Sorcery, a lot to chew on. The phone lines are full. We'll get to as many of your calls as we can. I ask you to please be considerate of your fellow Coast listeners and get right to the point when we call on you. We'll be right back. We go to the phones. First-time caller, Aaron in Palm Springs. Hi, Aaron. You're on with Joseph Farrell.
Thank you so
Hello?
Much for taking my call.
Thank you.
Oh, my gosh. It's I listen to you guys every night, and so does my dad. I'm 39, and he's 70, and we call each other on the breaks and talk about all the content. It's just amazing. Thank you so much.
All right. Well, we're glad to have you here. What's on your mind?
Yes. I have a very close friend of mine here. I don't want to say his name here, but he actually worked at the flight school in Venice, Florida. And like you said, he has a disability, and so he never really spoke to anybody about it. But they were asking about maps and how far was how far was the Trade Center from where they were at. But really, the thing that always stuck with me, and I don't know if you're still doing current research, and maybe you could take my number or something offline, but I know he's never spoken of this, but actually one of the guys gave him a envelope, and they opened it in the staff room, and it actually had anthrax in it, and one of the ladies ended up going to the hospital, and he pretty much moved to California and didn't come back to work after that day.
Oh, wow.
I don't know if you've ever heard anything like that. I mean, just like I said,
I have heard similar reports, Aaron, of things like that. Of course, there was that whole anthrax scare, and I don't even really get into that in the book, but that's another aspect of the 9/11. You had anthrax being mailed to members of Congress. I recall that the then Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle from my home state in South Dakota was a recipient of one of these letters. And if I recall correctly, there were even some anthrax scares at the FBI. So that to me is another indicator, you know, when you're dealing with weaponized anthrax, again, you're dealing with deep state, you're dealing with people with the biological labs and capability to produce that stuff. So this is not something that an ordinary terrorist is going to have access to.
Thanks, Aaron. Yeah, you don't whip up a batch of that in the bathtub.
No, you don't.
East of the Rockies, Larry in Fort Wayne. Hi, Larry. You're on with Joseph Farrell.
Hey, guys. How you doing tonight? Great show.
Thanks.
Quick question for you. The second Gulf War, we hunted Saddam Hussein and his two boys.
Right.
We caught up with his two boys. They were killed in a firefight. I remember vividly watching the news as their bodies were cleaned up and they were displayed on television. To show the world that we had caught Uday and Kude, the sons of Saddam Hussein, mm-hmm. and now we got to find him.
Mm-hmm.
Now, flash forward 10 years, and we're hunting still the most wanted man in history, Bin Laden. We supposedly catch up with him, kill him, but instead of plastering him on the world news to show that we got the worst man in history, he was buried within 24 hours. To appease Islamic law.
Mm-hmm.
I want to know the guest's opinion on that tonight, if that was just circumstantial or if it was a real deal.
Thanks, Larry.
Well, Larry, I have a number of suspicions about that whole story in the first place. If you recall, prior to his final death, there were a number of other news reports that began sometime around 2003, 2004, if I recall correctly, that Bin Laden had in fact died. So you're dealing here with the case of a man that died more than once. And I suspect that because of this, you know, he was useful as a patsy. But what I can't figure out is if he's the criminal mastermind, you would at least think that they would have wanted to interrogate him for a while. So I suspect either that the story of his death may have been something put out there to cover up the fact that maybe they were trying to interrogate him, or that they may have apprehended someone, you know, who may not have been Bin Laden at all, and simply put the story out there to end that aspect of the narrative. But I'm highly suspicious of that death. And burial so quickly, it doesn't, as you've indicated, it doesn't fit the pattern that we saw with Saddam Hussein and his boys.
Well, I guess you could say that there would have been elements that wouldn't want him taken alive, that's for sure.
Exactly.
We're going to go to the wild card line. Karen from here in Las Vegas. Hi, Karen. Good morning.
Great show, George. And Mr. Farrell, my husband has all your books, and we're both great admirers of yours.
Thank you.
I had a personal experience with Muhammad Atta in July 2001, very quickly. I was working at a casino dealing cards. He came in with this other guy. Now, this is really important for me because Muhammad was out of control. His eyes were like something I'd never seen before, really wild. He'd never said a word, but the guy with him, and I can't remember who it was, and it's a matter of public record, they were staying at the Stratosphere. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the guy with him stood right beside him, close to him, and always grabbing him by the arm, telling him what to do. So in light of that, in the last few years, when all this stuff came out about mind control with these massacres and stuff, do you think that it's possible that these guys who didn't know how to fly planes were being given directions over the radio in the cockpit of the planes as they flew into the towers, and because they were under mind control and on drugs and stuff?
I'm willing to entertain almost any scenario like that. It's clear that Atta's behavior was psychotic in the extreme in some cases. And there are little indicators I talk about in the book. His butchery of one of his so-called girlfriend's cats. Her cat had a litter of kittens, and he apparently had butchered them in an effort to kind of scare her and shock her. His behavior is psychotic. It's typical of someone under extreme mental stress, perhaps pressure, perhaps mind manipulation, drug use, and so on and so forth. So I'm willing to entertain almost any hypothesis as far as he and some of the other hijackers go.
So Karen, if you're still there?
Yes.
What did the other guy look like? Did he look like, no. Was he Arab?
I don't
even
remember because it was so long ago, and he looked Middle Eastern. That much I know. And there were like a half a dozen other employees who saw them and interacted with them also. But what I remember mostly is Muhammad Atta, because he was just like you were looking into the eyes of a wild animal. And the man with him stood right next to him the whole time with his arm right on him. And he was talking to him in his ear. Don't do this, don't do that. And when Muhammad Atta would get out of line, which I was a dealer then, and I was dealt him cards, and it was in the daytime, there was nobody there, he got mad, ripped up the cards, threw them on the table, and the other guy grabbed him by the arm and said, "You can't do that, we gotta go." And off they went, but they came back, and other employees interacted with them also in that same place.
Were you questioned by the FBI?
No. No, that's funny because I called the FBI when I saw his picture, a couple days or a couple months later when it all happened. And then I called them and they didn't ask me any questions. I just told them what I saw and they said, okay. And I said, I asked them, are you going to follow up with this or has anybody else seen them? They said, we don't give information. They don't give any information.
Right.
Apparently, they didn't want to take any either. Thanks. I'm sorry. Thank you, Karen. I appreciate your input. That was some interesting stuff. Any other comment on that, Joe? Joseph?
Well, the kind of behavior she's talking about, yeah, that would have been the first things to leap to my mind, too. And, I've worked in casinos and dealt in the pits and been a pit boss and you notice you're kind of trained and taught to notice behavior like that, and that kind of behavior does kind of stick out in the mind as either being someone under the influence of drugs, perhaps going into or coming out of a period of use, or some type of mind manipulation, or both. It doesn't surprise me at all. It fits the pattern of things that other researchers have uncovered about him.
And it sounds like he had a handler almost.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
On the wild card line from New York City, Amayat. I hope I'm not mispronouncing that too much?
Well, you were close. It's actually Maat, the Kemetic Egyptian goddess of truth, justice, right, and balance. Thank you, both of you gentlemen, for this important program this morning. The Achilles heel of the fascism coming down globally, the perpetual warring, the lack of civil liberties, the Achilles heel of all of that is September 11th, 01, so we must continue to deal with fifth grade science and other. But a brief two-part question, Joseph, and I'm looking forward to reading this book and your other books, too. The first part is I'd like some of your thoughts around the theory that the planes, being that the maneuvers weren't possible, the Pentagon footage doesn't show any plane, were holograms. And the second part of my question deals with the dancing Israelis. So I'm sure you know this story. They were celebrating. They had all kinds of things in the van. And then when they, after they were detained for a short while, they returned to Israel. And they, on a TV talk program, they revealed certain important things. And, of course, Dr. Jim Fetzer and Chris Bolin also bring out the Mossad connection. And I'll listen over the air. Thank you so much for this program.
Thanks, Maat.
I'm not a subscriber to the holographic planes theory. I think that theory just has too many problems, not the least of which are all the people in New York themselves that are reacting, you know, to the planes and so on, particularly in that French video that emerged shortly after 9/11. You know, you hear people hear the airplanes screaming in, they look up, and then wham, you see it hit. I think the hologram theory just has too many problems in that respect. As far as the dancing Israelis go, this is an aspect of the story that's profoundly disturbing. The Mossad did brief American intelligence about a pending terrorist operation. And then in addition to this, you had an Israeli spy ring that I talk about in the book being run in this country prior to 9/11 called the Art Student Spy Ring. And apparently they had a number of the alleged hijackers under their own Israeli surveillance prior to 9/11. So there is an Israeli aspect in the deep layers of this story, but I'm one of those that doesn't think that Israel was necessarily involved in any of the planning or execution of it, because I think geopolitically Israel would have too much to lose if that were ever to come to light. They are very dependent on American aid and goodwill. They're very dependent on European aid and goodwill. I think if you're looking for potential Israeli involvement, you have to look much deeper to certain elements within Israel that are deeply, deeply connected historically to some of these fascist global networks that I've been talking about. But
yeah, you would think on one level that Israel or Israelis would not be in league if they knew that there was a Nazi connection.
Right. Well, that aspect of the story is a little known story, George. It goes back to things that were done during World War II that a fellow excellent researcher by the name of Christopher Simpson, in a book called Blowback, talks about. He points out that at one point there were actually arrangements between the SS and some very radical Zionist guerrilla groups operating in Palestine to be trained by the SS. This is actually a matter of record. So that's probably one of the most weird, you know, connections that you find in doing all of this type of research.
Wow. We'll go to Fran in Baltimore on the wild card line. Hi, Fran. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. I'm going to be brief, but I want to borrow an expression. When I watched on TV 9/11, and they were showing the airport, and they were showing the guy that's now wanted by the FBI, CIA, everybody's got his picture, and he's boldly walking through the airport. And I thought to myself, why would he go purchase a royal blue color shirt. It was almost like he wanted to be arrested or caught. And I thought to myself, something is rotten in Denmark with this. And then when he was able to just walk through, his face, his profile, a royal blue colored shirt, you know, to make sure, like, do you see me? Here I am. And it was just a theory of mine. This guy wanted to be stopped. Now, I just want your opinion on that. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Fran.
Well, Fran, I think you're onto something, because the behavior of some of these hijackers, particularly in some of the videos, is kind of blatant. And again, it raises the question that George and I talked about earlier, that, you know, with respect to Mohammed Atta particularly, you have fingerprints that to my mind clearly indicate that he was somebody's intelligence asset, maybe not necessarily ours, but somebody's intelligence asset, because his movements and his behavior are drawing so much attention to himself that it's almost like he's been ordered to do certain things in order to draw attention to himself. So yeah, you have the creation of a patsy, and like you, I find it very suspicious.
We're going to try to talk to Gordon in Lakeland, Florida. I think he's on Wildcard 4. Hi, Gordon.
Hey, thank you for taking my call, George and Joseph. Real quickly, you remember in World War II, we let the airplanes from Japan hit us, even though we saw them on the radar. I wanted to get your opinion on that. And secondly, I'm get confused between the difference between Level 2 and Level 3.
Okay. I'm not familiar with the episode during World War II that you're talking about. I assume that you're referring to Pearl Harbor and the fact that the Japanese flight from their carrier fleet was actually spotted by American radar. But if I remember the story carefully, the radar operators actually thought that it was a flight of B-17s that were being flown from the continent to Hawaii, and that they mistook the radar returns that they were seeing for that flight of B-17s. Now, what was the second question again, the level 2 and level 3 distinction?
Yes.
Yeah, level 2, just to be very brief, level 2 is what most 9/11 researchers have called the rogue network within the American deep state. So in other words, level 2 is confined to whatever American component is planning and helping execute the events on that day. Level 3 is, on the contrary, a global network. It's not confined just to America. It has a kind of fascist ideology. It's not afraid to use very exotic technologies to accomplish its aims. And one thing that we didn't discuss tonight is it's also apparently very well versed in the occult. And again, you know, the Nazis would certainly fit the bill in those respects.
Yeah, thanks for the call. Thanks to all the callers. We didn't even touch on the occult part of it, but that'll be another time. You'll have to come back. Joseph Farrell, thank you very much. It's a great book. I hope people check it out.
Take care.
All right, thank you. Thanks also to my colleagues there coast to coast, Jeff DeRay and Donna Walker, Dan Galante, our webmaster, Greg Bishop, and my producer, Chris Boros, who, by the way, congratulations, has been named New Mexico Radio Broadcaster of the Year. And thanks to our earlier guest, John Cushman, and Peter Erickson, and of course, as I mentioned, Joseph Farrell. I'll be back in a couple of weeks. Good night, everyone.